cannot get. When our will strains after a path we may not follow. We need neither starve from inanition, nor stand still in despair. We have but to seek another nourishment for the mind, as strong as the forbidden food it longed to taste, and perhaps purer. And to hew out for the adventurous foot a road as direct and broad as the one fortune has blocked up against us, if rougher than it. A year ago I was myself intensely miserable, because I thought I had made a mistake in entering the ministry. Its uniform duties wearied me to death. I burnt for the more active life of the world, for the more exciting toils of a literary career, for the destiny of an artist, author, orator, anything rather than that of a priest. Yes, the heart of a politician, of a soldier, of a votary of glory, a lover of renown, a luster after power beat under my curate's surplice. I considered. My life was so wretched, it must be changed, or I must die. After a season of darkness and struggling, light broke and relief fell. My cramped existence all at once spread out to a plain without bounds. My powers heard a call from heaven to rise, gather their full strength, spread their wings, and mount beyond ken. God had an errand for me. To bear which afar, to deliver it well, skill and strength, courage and eloquence, the best qualifications of soldier, statesman, and orator were all needed, for these all center in the good missionary. A missionary I resolved to be. From that moment my state of mind changed. The fetters dissolved and dropped from every faculty, leaving nothing of bondage but its galling soreness, which time only can heal. My father, indeed, opposed the determination, but since his death I have not a legitimate obstacle to contend with. Some affairs settled, a successor for Morton provided, an entanglement or two of the feelings broken through or cut asunder, at last conflict with human weakness, in which I know I shall overcome, because I have vowed that I will overcome. And I leave Europe for the East. He said this in his peculiar, subdued yet emphatic voice, looking, when he had ceased speaking, not at me, but at the setting sun, at which I looked too. Both he and I had our backs towards the path leading up the field to the wicket. We had heard no step on that grass-grown track. The water running in the vale was the one lulling sound of the hour and scene. We might well then start when a gay voice, sweet as a silver bell, exclaimed, "Good evening, Mr. Rivers." "And good evening, old Carlo. Your dog is quicker to recognize his friends than you are, sir. He pricked his ears and wagged his tail when I was at the bottom of the field, and you have your back towards me now." It was true. Though Mr. Rivers had started at the first of those musical accents, as if a thunderbolt had split a cloud over his head, he stood yet, at the close of the sentence, in the same attitude in which the speaker had surprised him, his arm resting on the gate, his face directed towards the west. He turned at last with measured deliberation. A vision, as it seemed to me, had risen at his side. There appeared, within 3 feet of him, a form clad in pure white, a youthful, graceful form, full, yet fine in contour, and when, after bending to caress Carlo, it lifted up its head and threw back a long veil, there bloomed under his glance a face of perfect beauty. Perfect beauty is a strong expression, but I do not retrace or qualify it. As sweet features as ever the temperate clime of Albion moulded, as pure hues of rose and lily as ever her humid gales and vapoury skies generated and screened, justified in this instance the term. No charm was wanting, no defect was perceptible. The young girl had regular and delicate lineaments, eyes shaped and coloured as we see them in lovely pictures, large and dark and full. The long and shadowy eyelash which encircles a fine eye with so soft a fascination, the pencilled brow which gives such clearness, the white smooth forehead which adds such repose to the livelier beauties of tint and ray, the cheek oval, fresh and smooth, the lips fresh too, ruddy, healthy, sweetly formed, the even and gleaming teeth without flaw, the small dimpled chin, the ornament of rich, plenteous tresses, all advantages, in short, which combined, realize the ideal of beauty, were fully hers. I wondered, as I looked at this fair creature. I admired her with my whole heart. Nature had surely formed her in a partial mood, and, forgetting her usual stinted stepmother dole of gifts, had endowed this, her darling, with a grand dame's bounty. What did St. John Rivers think of this earthly angel? I naturally asked myself that question as I saw him turn to her and look at her, and, as naturally, I sought the answer to the inquiry in his countenance. He had already withdrawn his eye from the Perry, and was looking at a humble tuft of daisies which grew by the wicket. "A lovely evening, but late for you to be out alone," he said, as he crushed the snowy heads of the closed flowers with his foot. "Oh, I only came home from—" She mentioned the name of a large town some 20 miles distant. "This afternoon. Papa told me you had opened your school, and that the new mistress was come. And so I put on my bonnet after tea and ran up the valley to see her. This is she?" Pointing to me.
"It is," said St. John.
"Do you think you shall like Morton?" she asked of me, with a direct and naive simplicity of tone and manner, pleasing, if childlike. "I hope I shall. I have many inducements to do so." "Did you find your scholars as attentive as you expected?" "Quite." "Do you like your house?" "Very much." "Have I furnished it nicely?" "Very nicely indeed." "And made a good choice of an attendant for you in Alice Wood?" "You have indeed. She is teachable and handy." This, then, I thought, is Miss Oliver, the heiress, favoured, it seems, in the gifts of fortune as well as in those of nature. What happy combination of the planets presided over her birth, I wonder. "I shall come up and help you to teach sometimes," she added. "It will be a change for me to visit you now and then, and I like a change. Mr. Rivers, I have been so gay during my stay. Last night, or rather this morning, I was dancing till 2 o'clock. The regiment are stationed there since the riots, and the officers are the most agreeable men in the world. They put all our young knife-grinders and scissor-merchants to shame." It seemed to me that Mr. St. John's underlip protruded, and his upper lip curled a moment. His mouth certainly looked a good deal compressed, and the lower part of his face unusually stern and square, as the laughing girl gave him this information. He lifted his gaze, too, from the daisies and turned it on her. An unsmiling, a searching, a meaning gaze it was. She answered it with a second laugh, and laughter well became her youth, her roses, her dimples, her bright eyes. As he stood, mute and grave, she again fell to caressing Carlo.
"Poor Carlo loves me," said she. "He is not stern and distant to his friends, and if he could speak, he would not be silent."
As she patted the dog's head, bending with native grace before his young and austere master, I saw a glow rise to that master's face. I saw his solemn eye melt with sudden fire and flicker with resistless emotion. Flushed and kindled thus, he looked nearly as beautiful for a man as she for a woman. His chest heaved once, as if his large heart, weary of despotic constriction, had expanded, despite the will, and made a vigorous bound for the attainment of liberty. But he curbed it, I think, as a resolute rider would curb a rearing steed. He responded neither by word nor movement to the gentle advances made him.
"Papa says you never come to see us now," continued Miss Oliver, looking up. "You are quite a stranger at Vale Hall. He is alone this evening and not very well. Will you return with me and visit him?"
"It is not a seasonable hour to intrude on Mr. Oliver," answered St. John.
"Not a seasonable hour? But I declare it is. It is just the hour when Papa most wants company, when the works are closed and he has no business to occupy him. Now, Mr. Rivers, do come. Why are you so very shy and so very sombre?"
She filled up the hiatus his silence left by a reply of her own.
"I forgot," she exclaimed, shaking her beautiful curled head as if shocked at herself. "I am so giddy and thoughtless. Do excuse me. It had slipped my memory that you have good reasons to be indisposed for joining in my chatter. Diana and Mary have left you, and Moor House is shut up, and you're so lonely. I am sure I pity you. Do come and see Papa.
Not tonight, Miss Rosamond. Not tonight.
Mr. St. John spoke almost like an automaton. Himself only knew the effort it cost him thus to refuse.
Well, if you are so obstinate, I will leave you, for I dare not stay any longer. The dew begins to fall. Good evening.
She held out her hand.
He just touched it. Good evening,
he repeated in a voice low and hollow as an echo. She turned, but in a moment returned.
Are you well? She asked.
Well might she put the question. His face was blanched as her gown.
Quite well,
he enunciated, and with a bow he left the gate. She went one way, he another. She turned twice to gaze after him as she tripped fairy-like down the field. He, as he strode firmly across, never turned at all. This spectacle of another's suffering and sacrifice wrapped my thoughts from exclusive meditation on my own. Diana Rivers had designated her brother inexorable as death. She had not exaggerated.
Chapter 32. I continued the labours of the village school as actively and faithfully as I could. It was truly hard work at first. Some time elapsed before, with all my efforts, I could comprehend my scholars and their nature. Wholly untaught, with faculties quite torpid, they seemed to me hopelessly dull, and, at first sight, all dull alike. But I soon found I was mistaken. There was a difference amongst them as amongst the educated. And when I got to know them, and they me, this difference rapidly developed itself. Their amazement at me, my language, my rules and ways, once subsided, I found some of these heavy-looking, gaping rustics wake up into sharp-witted girls enough. Many showed themselves obliging and amiable too, and I discovered amongst them not a few examples of natural politeness and innate self-respect, as well as of excellent capacity, that won both my goodwill and my admiration. These soon took a pleasure in doing their work well, in keeping their persons neat, in learning their tasks regularly, in acquiring quiet and orderly manners. The rapidity of their progress in some instances was even surprising, and an honest and happy pride I took in it. Besides, I began personally to like some of the best girls, and they liked me. I had amongst my scholars several farmers' daughters, young women grown almost. These could already read, write, and sew, and to them I taught the elements of grammar, geography, history, and the finer kinds of needlework. I found estimable characters amongst them, characters desirous of information and disposed for improvement, with whom I passed many a pleasant evening hour in their own homes. Their parents then, the farmer and his wife, loaded me with attentions. There was an enjoyment in accepting their simple kindness, and in repaying it by a consideration, a scrupulous regard to their feelings, to which they were not, perhaps at all times accustomed, and which both charmed and benefited them, because, while it elevated them in their own eyes, it made them emulous to merit the deferential treatment they received. I felt I became a favourite in the neighbourhood. Whenever I went out, I heard on all sides cordial salutations, and was welcomed with friendly smiles. To live amidst general regard, though it be but the regard of working people, is like sitting in sunshine calm and sweet. Serene inward feelings bud and bloom under the ray. At this period of my life, my heart far oftener swelled with thankfulness than sank with dejection. And yet, reader, to tell you all, in the midst of this calm, this useful existence, after a day passed in honourable exertion amongst my scholars, an evening spent in drawing or reading contentedly alone, I used to rush into strange dreams at night. Dreams many-coloured, agitated, full of the ideal, the stirring, the stormy. Dreams where, amidst unusual scenes charged with adventure, with agitating risk and romantic chance, I still again and again met Mr. Rochester, always at some exciting crisis, and then the sense of being in his arms, hearing his voice, meeting his eye, touching his hand and cheek, loving him, being loved by him, the hope of passing a lifetime at his side would be renewed, with all its first force and fire. Then I awoke. Then I recalled where I was and how situated.
Then I rose up on my curtainless bed, trembling and quivering, and then the still dark night witnessed the convulsion of despair, and heard the burst of passion. By 9 o'clock the next morning I was punctually opening the school, tranquil, settled, prepared for the steady duties of the day. Rosamond Oliver kept her word in coming to visit me. Her call at the school was generally made in the course of her morning ride. She would canter up to the door on her pony, followed by a mounted livery servant. Anything more exquisite than her appearance, in her purple habit, with her Amazon's cap of black velvet placed gracefully above the long curls that kissed her cheek and floated to her shoulders, can scarcely be imagined. And it was thus she would enter the rustic building and glide through the dazzled ranks of the village children. She generally came at the hour when Mr. Rivers was engaged in giving his daily catechizing lesson. Keenly, I fear, did the eye of the visitress pierce the young pastor's heart. A sort of instinct seemed to warn him of her entrance, even when he did not see it, and when he was looking quite away from the door, if she appeared at it, his cheek would glow, and his marble-seeming features, though they refused to relax, changed indescribably, and in their very quiescence became expressive of a repressed fervour, stronger than working muscle or darting glance could indicate. Of course she knew her power. Indeed, he did not, because he could not conceal it from her. In spite of his Christian stoicism, when she went up and addressed him, and smiled gaily, encouragingly, even fondly in his face, his hand would tremble and his eye burn. He seemed to say, with his sad and resolute look, if he did not say it with his lips, "I love you, and I know you prefer me. It is not despair of success that keeps me dumb. If I offered my heart, I believe you would accept it. But that heart is already laid on a sacred altar. The fire is arranged round it. It will soon be no more than a sacrifice consumed." And she would pout like a disappointed child. A pensive cloud would soften her radiant vivacity. She would withdraw her hand hastily from his, and turn in transient petulance from his aspect, at once so heroic and so martyr-like. St. John, no doubt, would have given the world to follow, recall, retain her, when she thus left him. But he would not give one chance of heaven, nor relinquish for the Elysium of her love one hope of the true eternal paradise. Besides, he could not bind all that he had in his nature, the rover, the aspirant, the poet, the priest, in the limits of a single passion. He could not, he would not, renounce his wild field of mission warfare for the parlours and the peace of Vale Hall. I learnt so much from himself, in an inroad I once, despite his reserve, had the daring to make on his confidence. Miss Oliver already honoured me with frequent visits to my cottage. I had learnt her whole character, which was without mystery or disguise. She was coquettish, but not heartless, exacting, but not worthlessly selfish. She had been indulged from her birth, but was not absolutely spoilt. She was hasty, but good-humoured. Vain, she could not help it, when every glance in the glass showed her such a flush of loveliness, but not affected. Liberal-handed, innocent of the pride of wealth, ingenuous, sufficiently intelligent, gay, lively, and unthinking, she was very charming, in short, even to a cool observer of her own sex like me. But she was not profoundly interesting or thoroughly impressive. A very different sort of mind was hers from that, for instance, of the sisters of St. John. Still, I liked her almost as I liked my pupil Adele, except that, for a child whom we have watched over and taught, a closer affection is engendered than we can give an equally attractive adult acquaintance. She had taken an amiable caprice to me. She said I was like Mr. Rivers, only, certainly, she allowed, not one-tenth so handsome, though I was a nice, neat little soul enough, but he was an angel. I was, however, good, clever, composed, and firm, like him. I was a lusus naturae, she affirmed, as a village schoolmistress. She was sure my previous history, if known, would make a delightful romance. One evening, while, with her usual childlike activity, and thoughtless yet not offensive inquisitiveness, she was rummaging the cupboard and the table drawer of my little kitchen, she discovered first two French books, a volume of Schiller, a German grammar and dictionary, and then my drawing materials and some sketches, including a pencil head of a pretty little cherub-like girl, one of my scholars, and sundry views from nature taken in the Vale of Morton and on the surrounding moors. She was first transfixed with surprise, and then electrified with delight. Had I done these pictures? Did I know French and German? What a love! What a miracle I was! I drew better than her master in the first school. Would I sketch a portrait of her to show to Papa? With pleasure, I replied. And I felt a thrill of artist delight at the idea of copying from so perfect and radiant a model. She had then on a dark blue silk dress. Her arms and her neck were bare. Her only ornament was her chestnut tresses, which waved over her shoulders with all the wild grace of natural curls. I took a sheet of fine cardboard and drew a careful outline. I promised myself the pleasure of colouring it. And, as it was getting late then, I told her she must come and sit another day. She made such a report of me to her father that Mr. Oliver himself accompanied her next evening. A tall, massive-featured, middle-aged and grey-headed man, at whose side his lovely daughter looked like a bright flower near a hoary turret. He appeared a taciturn and perhaps a proud personage, but he was very kind to me. The sketch of Rosamond's portrait pleased him highly. He said I must make a finished picture of it. He insisted, too, on my coming the next day to spend the evening at Vale Hall. I went. I found it a large, handsome residence, showing abundant evidences of wealth in the proprietor. Rosamond was full of glee and pleasure all the time I stayed. Her father was affable, and when he entered into conversation with me after tea, he expressed in strong terms his approbation of what I had done in Morton School, and said he only feared, from what he saw and heard, I was too good for the place, and would soon quit it for one more suitable. "Indeed," cried Rosamond, "she is clever enough to be a governess in a high family, Papa." I thought I would far rather be where I am than in any high family in the land. Mr. Oliver spoke of Mr. Rivers, of the Rivers family, with great respect. He said it was a very old name in that neighbourhood, that the ancestors of the house were wealthy, that all Morton had once belonged to them, that even now he considered the representative of that house might, if he liked, make an alliance with the best. He accounted it a pity that so fine and talented a young man should have formed the design of going out as a missionary. It was quite throwing a valuable life away. It appeared, then, that her father would throw no obstacle in the way of Rosamond's union with St. John. Mr. Oliver evidently regarded the young clergyman's good birth, old name, and sacred profession as sufficient compensation for the want of fortune. It was the 5th of November, and a holiday. My little servant, after helping me to clean my house, was gone, well satisfied with the fee of a penny for her aid. All about me was spotless and bright. Scoured floor, polished grate, and well-rubbed chairs. I had also made myself neat, and had now the afternoon before me to spend as I would. The translation of a few pages of German occupied an hour. Then I got my palette and pencils, and fell to the more soothing, because easier, occupation of completing Rosamond Oliver's miniature. The head was finished already. There was but the background to tint and the drapery to shade off. A touch of carmine, too, to add to the ripe lips. A soft curl here and there to the tresses. A deeper tinge to the shadow of the lash under the azured eyelid. I was absorbed in the execution of these nice details when, after one rapid tap, my door unclosed, admitting St. John Rivers. "I am come to see how you are spending your holiday," he said. "Not, I hope, in thought. No, that is well. While you draw, you will not feel lonely. You see, I mistrust you still, though you have borne up wonderfully so far. I have brought you a book for evening solace." And he laid on the table a new publication, a poem, one of those genuine productions so often vouchsafed to the fortunate public of those days, the golden age of modern literature. Alas, the readers of our era are less favoured. But courage! I will not pause either to accuse or repine. I know poetry is not dead, nor genius lost, nor has mammon gained power over either to bind or slay. They will both assert their existence, their presence, their liberty and strength again one day. Powerful angels, safe in heaven, they smile when sordid souls triumph, and feeble ones weep over their destruction. Poetry destroyed? Genius banished? No. Mediocrity? No.
Do not let envy prompt you to the thought.
No, they not only live, but reign and redeem. And without their divine influence spread everywhere, you would be in hell, the hell of your own meanness.
While I was eagerly glancing at the bright pages of Marmion, for Marmion it was, St. John stooped to examine my drawing.
His tall figure sprang erect again with a start. He said nothing. I looked up at him. He shunned my eye. I knew his thoughts well, and could read his heart plainly. At the moment I felt calmer and cooler than he. I had then temporarily the advantage of him, and I conceived an inclination to do him some good if I could. With all his firmness and self-control, thought I, he tasks himself too far, locks every feeling and pang within, expresses, confesses, imparts nothing. I am sure it would benefit him to talk a little about this sweet Rosamond, whom he thinks he ought not to marry. I will make him talk. I said first, "Take a chair, Mr. Rivers." But he answered, as he always did, that he could not stay. "Very well," I responded, mentally, "stand if you like, but you shall not go just yet. I am determined. Solitude is at least as bad for you as it is for me. I'll try if I cannot discover the secret spring of your confidence, and find an aperture in that marble breast through which I can shed one drop of the balm of sympathy." "Is this portrait like?" I asked bluntly.
"Like? Like whom? I did not observe it closely."
"You did, Mr. Rivers." He almost started at my sudden and strange abruptness. He looked at me astonished. "Oh, that is nothing yet," I muttered within. "I don't mean to be baffled by a little stiffness on your part. I'm prepared to go to considerable lengths," I continued.
"You observed it closely and distinctly. But I have no objection to your looking at it again." And I rose and placed it in his hand.
"A well-executed picture," he said. "Very soft, clear colouring. Very graceful and correct drawing."
"Yes, yes, I know all that. But what of the resemblance? Who is it like?"
Mastering some hesitation, he answered,
"Miss Oliver, I presume?"
"Of course. And now, sir, to reward you for the accurate guess, I will promise to paint you a careful and faithful duplicate of this very picture, provided you admit that the gift would be acceptable to you. I don't wish to throw away my time and trouble on an offering you would deem worthless."
He continued to gaze at the picture. The longer he looked, the firmer he held it, the more he seemed to covet it.
"It is like," he murmured. "The eye is well managed. The colour, light, expression are perfect. It smiles."
"Would it comfort or would it wound you to have a similar painting? Tell me that. When you are at Madagascar, or at the Cape, or in India, would it be a consolation to have that memento in your possession? Or would the sight of it bring recollections calculated to enervate and distress?"
He now furtively raised his eyes. He glanced at me, irresolute, disturbed. He again surveyed the picture.
"That I should like to have it is certain. Whether it would be judicious or wise is another question."
Since I had ascertained that Rosamond really preferred him, and that her father was not likely to oppose the match, I, less exalted in my views than St. John, had been strongly disposed in my own heart to advocate their union. It seemed to me that, should he become the possessor of Mr. Oliver's large fortune, he might do as much good with it as if he went and laid his genius out to wither and his strength to waste under a tropical sun. With this persuasion I now answered, "As far as I can see, it would be wiser and more judicious if you were to take to yourself the original at once." By this time he had sat down. He had laid the picture on the table before him, and with his brow supported on both hands, hung fondly over it. I discerned he was now neither angry nor shocked at my audacity. I saw even that to be thus frankly addressed on a subject he had deemed unapproachable, to hear it thus freely handled, was beginning to be felt by him as a new pleasure, an unhoped-for relief. Reserved people often really need the frank discussion of their sentiments and griefs more than the expansive. The sternest-seeming stoic is human after all, and to burst with boldness and goodwill into the silent sea of their souls is often to confer on them the first of obligations. "She likes you, I am sure," said I, as I stood behind his chair. "And her father respects you. Moreover, she is a sweet girl, rather thoughtless, but you would have sufficient thought for both yourself and her. You ought to marry her.
Does she like me?
He asked. Certainly. Better than she likes anyone else. She talks of you continually. There is no subject she enjoys so much or touches upon so often.
It is very pleasant to hear this,
he said.
Very. Go on for another quarter of an hour.
And he actually took out his watch and laid it upon the table to measure the time. But where is the use of going on? I asked, when you are probably preparing some iron blow of contradiction, or forging a fresh chain to fetter your heart.
Don't imagine such hard things.
Fancy me yielding and melting, as I am doing. Human love rising like a freshly opened fountain in my mind and overflowing with sweet inundation all the field I have so carefully and with such labour prepared, so assiduously sown with the seeds of good intentions, of self-denying plans. And now it is deluged with a nectarous flood, the young germs swamped, delicious poison cankering them. Now I see myself stretched on an ottoman in the drawing-room at Vale Hall, at my bride Rosamond Oliver's feet. She is talking to me with her sweet voice, gazing down on me with those eyes your skilful hand has copied so well, smiling at me with these coral lips. She is mine. I am hers. This present life and passing world suffice to me.
Hush! Say nothing. My heart is full of delight. My senses are entranced. Let the time I marked pass in peace.
I humoured him. The watch ticked on. He breathed fast and low. I stood silent. Amidst this hush, the quarter sped. He replaced the watch, laid the picture down, rose, and stood on the hearth.
Now, said he, that little space was given to delirium and delusion. I rested my temples on the breast of temptation, and put my neck voluntarily under her yoke of flowers. I tasted her cup. The pillow was burning. There is an asp in the garland. The wine has a bitter taste. Her promises are hollow, her offers false. I see and know all this. I gazed at him in wonder. It is strange, pursued he, that while I love Rosamond Oliver so wildly, with all the intensity indeed of a first passion, the object of which is exquisitely beautiful, graceful, fascinating, I experience at the same time a calm, unwarped consciousness that she would not make me a good wife, that she is not the partner suited to me, that I should discover this within a year after marriage, and that to 12 months' rapture would succeed a lifetime of regret. This I know.
Strange indeed, I could not help ejaculating.
While something in me, he went on, is acutely sensible to her charms, something else is as deeply impressed with her defects. They are such that she could sympathize in nothing I aspired to, cooperate in nothing I undertook. Rosamond, a sufferer, a laborer, a female apostle, Rosamond, a missionary's wife, no!
But you need not be a missionary. You might relinquish that scheme.
Relinquish? What? My vocation? My great work? My foundation laid on earth for a mansion in heaven? My hopes of being numbered in the band who have merged all ambitions in the glorious one of bettering their race, of carrying knowledge into the realms of ignorance, of substituting peace for war, freedom for bondage, religion for superstition, the hope of heaven for the fear of hell? Must I relinquish that? It is dearer than the blood in my veins. It is what I have to look forward to, and to live for.
After a considerable pause, I said, And Miss Oliver, are her disappointment and sorrow of no interest to you?
Miss Oliver is ever surrounded by suitors and flatterers. In less than a month, my image will be effaced from her heart. She will forget me, and will marry probably someone who will make her far happier than I should do.
You speak coolly enough, but you suffer in the conflict. You're wasting away.
No. If I get a little thin, it is with anxiety about my prospects yet unsettled, my departure continually procrastinated. Only this morning I received intelligence that the successor, whose arrival I have been so long expecting, cannot be ready to replace me for 3 months to come yet. And perhaps the 3 months may extend to 6.
You tremble and become flushed whenever Miss Oliver enters the schoolroom. Again the surprised expression crossed his face. He had not imagined that a woman would dare to speak so to a man. For me, I felt at home in this sort of discourse. I could never rest in communication with strong, discreet, and refined minds, whether male or female, till I had passed the outworks of conventional reserve and crossed the threshold of confidence, and won a place by their heart's very hearthstone.
"You are original," said he, "and not timid. There is something brave in your spirit, as well as penetrating in your eye. But allow me to assure you that you partially misinterpret my emotions. You think them more profound and potent than they are. You give me a larger allowance of sympathy than I have a just claim to. When I colour, and when I shade before Miss Oliver, I do not pity myself. I scorn the weakness. I know it is ignoble. A mere fever of the flesh, not, I declare, the convulsion of the soul. That is just as fixed as a rock firm set in the depths of a restless sea. Know me to be what I am, a cold, hard man." I smiled incredulously. "You have taken my confidence by storm," he continued, "and now it is much at your service. I am simply, in my original state, stripped of that blood-bleached robe with which Christianity covers human deformity, a cold, hard, ambitious man. Natural affection only, of all the sentiments, has permanent power over me. Reason, and not feeling, is my guide. My ambition is unlimited. My desire to rise higher, to do more than others, insatiable. I honor endurance, perseverance, industry, talent, because these are the means by which men achieve great ends and mount to lofty eminence. I watch your career with interest, because I consider you a specimen of a diligent, orderly, energetic woman. Not because I deeply compassionate what you have gone through, or what you still suffer. You would describe yourself as a mere pagan philosopher," I said. "No. There is this difference between me and deistic philosophers. I believe. And I believe the gospel. You missed your epithet. I am not a pagan, but a Christian philosopher. A follower of the sect of Jesus. As his disciple, I adopt his pure, his merciful, his benignant doctrines. I advocate them. I am sworn to spread them. Won in youth to religion, she has cultivated my original qualities thus. From the minute germ, natural affection, she has developed the overshadowing tree, philanthropy. From the wild, stringy root of human uprightness, she has reared a due sense of the divine justice. Of the ambition to win power and renown for my wretched self, she has formed the ambition to spread my master's kingdom, to achieve victories for the standard of the cross. So much has religion done for me, turning the original materials to the best account, pruning and training nature. But she could not eradicate nature, nor will it be eradicated till this mortal shall put on immortality." Having said this, he took his hat, which lay on the table beside my pallet. Once more he looked at the portrait. "She is lovely," he murmured. "She is well named the Rose of the World, indeed. And may I not paint one like it for you?" "Cui bono? No." He drew over the picture the sheet of thin paper on which I was accustomed to rest my hand in painting, to prevent the cardboard from being sullied. What he suddenly saw on this blank paper, it was impossible for me to tell, but something had caught his eye. He took it up with a snatch. He looked at the edge.
then shot a glance at me, inexpressibly peculiar and quite incomprehensible, a glance that seemed to take and make note of every point in my shape, face, and dress, for it traversed all quick, keen as lightning. His lips parted as if to speak, but he checked the coming sentence, whatever it was. "What is the matter?" I asked. "Nothing in the world," was the reply, and replacing the paper, I saw him dexterously tear a narrow slip from the margin. It disappeared in his glove, and, with one hasty nod and good afternoon, he vanished. "Well," I exclaimed, using an expression of the district, "that caps the globe, however." I, in my turn, scrutinized the paper, but saw nothing on it save a few dingy stains of paint where I had tried the tint in my pencil. I pondered the mystery a minute or two, but finding it insolvable, and being certain it could not be of much moment, I dismissed and soon forgot it. Chapter 33. When Mr. St. John went, it was beginning to snow. The whirling storm continued all night. The next day a keen wind brought fresh and blinding falls. By twilight the valley was drifted up and almost impassable. I had closed my shutter, laid a mat to the door to prevent the snow from blowing in under it, trimmed my fire, and after sitting nearly an hour on the hearth listening to the muffled fury of the tempest, I lit a candle, took down Marmion, and beginning. Day set on Norham's castled steep, and Tweed's fair river broad and deep, and Cheviot's mountains lone. The massive towers, the donjon keep, the flanking walls that round them sweep, in yellow luster shone. I soon forgot storm in music. I heard a noise, the wind I thought shook the door. No, it was St. John Rivers, who, lifting the latch, came in out of the frozen hurricane, the howling darkness, and stood before me, the cloak that covered his tall figure all white as a glacier. I was almost in consternation, so little had I expected any guest from the blocked-up vale that night. "Any ill news?" I demanded. "Has anything happened?"
"No. How very easily alarmed you are,"
he answered, removing his cloak and hanging it up against the door, towards which he again coolly pushed the mat which his entrance had deranged. He stamped the snow from his boots.
"I shall sully the purity of your floor," said he, "but you must excuse me for once."
Then he approached the fire.
"I have had hard work to get here, I assure you,"
he observed, as he warmed his hands over the flame.
"One drift took me up to the waist. Happily the snow is quite soft yet."
"But why are you come?" I could not forbear saying.
"Rather an inhospitable question to put to a visitor, but since you ask it, I answer simply to have a little talk with you. I got tired of my mute books and empty rooms. Besides, since yesterday I have experienced the excitement of a person to whom a tale has been half told, and who is impatient to hear the sequel."
He sat down. I recalled his singular conduct of yesterday, and really I began to fear his wits were touched. If he were insane, however, his was a very cool and collected insanity. I had never seen that handsome-featured face of his look more like chiselled marble than it did just now, as he put aside his snow-wet hair from his forehead and let the firelight shine free on his pale brow and cheek as pale, where it grieved me to discover the hollow trace of care or sorrow now so plainly graved. I waited, expecting he would say something I could at least comprehend. But his hand was now at his chin, his finger on his lip. He was thinking. It struck me that his hand looked wasted like his face. A perhaps uncalled-for gush of pity came over my heart. I was moved to say, "I wish Diana or Mary would come and live with you. It is too bad that you should be quite alone, and you are recklessly rash about your own health."
"Not at all," said he. "I care for myself when necessary. I am well now. What do you see amiss in me?"
This was said with a careless, abstracted indifference, which showed that my solicitude was, at least in his opinion, wholly superfluous. I was silenced. He still slowly moved his finger over his upper lip, and still his eye dwelt dreamily on the glowing grate. Thinking it urgent to say something, I asked him presently if he felt any cold draught from the door which was behind him.
"No, no,"
he responded shortly and somewhat testily.
Well, I reflected, if you won't talk, you may be still. I'll let you alone now and return to my book.
So I snuffed the candle and resumed the perusal of Marmion.
He soon stirred. My eye was instantly drawn to his movements.
He only took out a Morocco pocketbook, thence produced a letter, which he read in silence, folded it, put it back, relapsed into meditation. It was vain to try to read with such an inscrutable fixture before me. Nor could I, in impatience, consent to be dumb. He might rebuff me if he liked, but talk I would.
Have you heard from Diana and Mary lately?
Not since the letter I showed you a week ago.
There has not been any change made about your own arrangements? You will not be summoned to leave England sooner than you expected?
I fear not, indeed. Such chance is too good to befall me. Baffled so far, I changed my ground. I bethought myself to talk about the school and my scholars.
Mary Garrett's mother is better, and Mary came back to the school this morning. And I shall have four new girls next week from the Foundry Close.
They would have come today but for the snow.
Indeed. Mr. Oliver pays for two.
Does he?
He means to give the whole school a treat at Christmas.
I know.
Was it your suggestion?
No.
Whose, then?
His daughter's, I think.
It is like her. She is so good-natured.
Yes.
Again came the blank of a pause. The clock struck eight strokes. It aroused him. He uncrossed his legs, sat erect, turned to me.
Leave your book a moment and come a little nearer the fire, he said.
Wondering, and of my wonder finding no end, I complied.
Half an hour ago, he pursued, I spoke of my impatience to hear the sequel of a tale. On reflection, I find the matter will be better managed by my assuming the narrator's part and converting you into a listener. Before commencing, it is but fair to warn you that the story will sound somewhat hackneyed in your ears. But stale details often regain a degree of freshness when they pass through new lips. For the rest, whether trite or novel, it is short. 20 years ago, a poor curate, never mind his name at this moment, fell in love with a rich man's daughter. She fell in love with him, and married him, against the advice of all her friends, who consequently disowned her immediately after the wedding. Before 2 years passed, the rash pair were both dead, and laid quietly side by side under one slab. I have seen their grave. It formed part of the pavement of a huge churchyard surrounding the grim, soot-black old cathedral of an overgrown manufacturing town. They left a daughter, which, at its very birth, Charity received in her lap. Cold as that of the snowdrift I almost stuck fast into night. Charity carried the friendless thing to the house of its rich maternal relations. It was reared by an aunt-in-law, called, I come to names now, Mrs. Reed of Gateshead. You start. Did you hear a noise? I dare say it is only a rat scrambling along the rafters of the adjoining schoolroom. It was a barn before I had it repaired and altered, and barns are generally haunted by rats. To proceed, Mrs. Reed kept the orphan 10 years. Whether it was happy or not with her, I cannot say, never having been told. But at the end of that time she transferred it to a place you know, being no other than Lowood School, where you so long resided yourself. It seems her career there was very honourable. From a pupil she became a teacher. Like yourself, really it strikes me there are parallel points in her history and yours. She left it to be a governess. There again, your fates were analogous. She undertook the education of the ward of a certain Mr. Rochester.
Mr. Rivers, I interrupted.
I can guess your feelings, he said, but restrain them for a while. I have nearly finished. Hear me to the end. Of Mr. Rochester's character I know nothing, but the one fact that he professed to offer honourable marriage to this young girl, and that at the very altar she discovered he had a wife yet alive, though a lunatic. What his subsequent conduct and proposals were is a matter of pure conjecture. But when an event transpired which rendered inquiry after the governess necessary, it was discovered she was gone. No one could tell when, where, or how. She had left Thornfield Hall in the night. Every research after her course had been vain. The country had been scoured far and wide. No vestige of information could be gathered respecting her. Yet that she should be found is become a matter of serious urgency. Advertisements have been put in all the papers. I myself have received a letter from one Mr. Briggs, a solicitor, communicating the details I have just imparted. Is it not an odd tale?
Just tell me this, said I. And since you know so much, you surely can tell it me. What of Mr. Rochester? How and where is he? What is he doing? Is he well?
I am ignorant of all concerning Mr. Rochester. The letter never mentions him but to narrate the fraudulent and illegal attempt I have adverted to. You should rather ask the name of the governess. The nature of the event which requires her appearance.
Did no one go to Thornfield Hall, then? Did no one see Mr. Rochester?
I suppose not.
But they wrote to him.
Of course.
And what did he say? Who has his letters?
Mr. Briggs intimates that the answer to his application was not from Mr. Rochester, but from a lady. It is signed Alice Fairfax.
I felt cold and dismayed. My worst fears then were probably true. He had in all probability left England and rushed in reckless desperation to some former haunt on the continent. And what opiate for his severe sufferings? What object for his strong passions had he sought there? I dared not answer the question. Oh, my poor master, once almost my husband, whom I had often called my dear Edward.
He must have been a bad man, observed Mr. Rivers.
You don't know him. Don't pronounce an opinion upon him, I said with warmth.
Very well,
he answered quietly.
And indeed, my head is otherwise occupied than with him. I have my tale to finish. Since you won't ask the governess's name, I must tell it of my own accord.
Stay, I have it here.
It is always more satisfactory to see important points written down, fairly committed to black and white.
And the pocketbook was again deliberately produced, opened, sought through. From one of its compartments was extracted a shabby slip of paper, hastily torn off. I recognized in its texture and its stains of ultramarine and lake and vermilion the ravished margin of the portrait cover. He got up, held it close to my eyes, and I read, traced in Indian ink, in my own handwriting, the words Jane Eyre, the work doubtless of some moment of abstraction.
Briggs wrote to me of a Jane Eyre, he said. The advertisements demanded a Jane Eyre. I knew a Jane Elliot. I confess I had my suspicions, but it was only yesterday afternoon they were at once resolved into certainty. You own the name and renounce the alias?
Yes, yes, but where is Mr. Briggs? He perhaps knows more of Mr. Rochester than you do.
Briggs is in London. I should doubt his knowing anything at all about Mr. Rochester. It is not in Mr. Rochester he is interested. Meantime, you forget essential points in pursuing trifles. You do not inquire why Mr. Briggs sought after you, what he wanted with you.
Well, what did he want?
Merely to tell you that your uncle, Mr. Eyre of Madeira, is dead, that he has left you all his property, and that you are now rich. Merely that, nothing more.
I? Rich?
Yes, you, rich. Quite an heiress.
Silence succeeded.
You must prove your identity, of course,
resumed St. John presently.
A step which will offer no difficulties. You can then enter on immediate possession. Your fortune is vested in the English funds. Briggs has the will and the necessary documents.
Here was a new card turned up. It is a fine thing, reader, to be lifted in a moment from indigence to wealth, a very fine thing, but not a matter one can comprehend, or consequently enjoy all at once. And then there are other chances in life far more thrilling and rapture-giving. This is solid, an affair of the actual world,
Nothing ideal about it. All its associations are solid and sober, and its manifestations are the same. One does not jump and spring and shout hurrah at hearing one has got a fortune. One begins to consider responsibilities and to ponder business. On a base of steady satisfaction rise certain grave cares, and we contain ourselves and brood over our bliss with a solemn brow. Besides, the words legacy, bequest, go side by side with the words death, funeral. My uncle, I had heard, was dead. My only relative. Ever since being made aware of his existence, I had cherished the hope of one day seeing him. Now I never should. And then this money came only to me. Not to me and a rejoicing family, but to my isolated self. It was a grand boon, doubtless. And independence would be glorious. Yes, I felt that. That thought swelled my heart.
"You unbend your forehead at last," said Mr. Rivers. "I thought Medusa had looked at you and that you were turning to stone. Perhaps now you will ask how much you are worth."
"How much am I worth?"
"Oh, a trifle. Nothing, of course, to speak of. 20,000 pounds, I think they say. But what is that?"
20,000 pounds? Here was a new stunner. I had been calculating on 4,000 or 5,000. This news actually took my breath for a moment. Mr. St. John, whom I had never heard laugh before, laughed now.
"Well," said he, "if you had committed a murder, and I had told you your crime was discovered, you could scarcely look more aghast."
"It is a large sum. Don't you think there is a mistake?"
"No mistake at all."
"Perhaps you have read the figures wrong. It may be 2,000.
"It is written in letters, not figures. 20,000.
I again felt rather like an individual of but average gastronomical powers, sitting down to feast alone at a table spread with provisions for 100. Mr. Rivers rose now and put his cloak on.
"If it were not such a very wild night," he said, "I would send Hannah down to keep you company. You look too desperately miserable to be left alone. But Hannah, poor woman, could not stride the drift so well as I. Her legs are not quite so long. So I must e'en leave you to your sorrows. Good night."
He was lifting the latch. A sudden thought occurred to me. "Stop 1 minute," I cried.
"Well?"
"It puzzles me to know why Mr. Briggs wrote to you about me, or how he knew you, or could fancy that you, living in such an out-of-the-way place, had the power to aid in my discovery."
"Oh, I am a clergyman," he said, "and the clergy are often appealed to about odd matters."
Again the latch rattled. "No, that does not satisfy me," I exclaimed, and indeed there was something in the hasty and unexplanatory reply which, instead of allaying, piqued my curiosity more than ever. "It is a very strange piece of business," I added. "I must know more about it."
"Another time."
"No, tonight, tonight!" And as he turned from the door, I placed myself between it and him. He looked rather embarrassed. "You certainly shall not go till you have told me all," I said.
"I would rather not just now."
"You shall. You must."
"I would rather Diana or Mary informed you."
Of course these objections wrought my eagerness to a climax. Gratified it must be, and that without delay, and I told him so.
"But I apprised you that I was a hard man," said he, "difficult to persuade."
"And I am a hard woman, impossible to put off."
"And then," he pursued, "I am cold. No fervor infects me."
"Whereas I am hot, and fire dissolves ice. The blaze there has thawed all the snow from your cloak. By the same token it has streamed onto my floor and made it like a trampled street. As you hope ever to be forgiven, Mr. Rivers, the high crime and misdemeanor of spoiling a sanded kitchen, tell me what I wish to know."
"Well, then," he said, "I yield, if not to your earnestness, to your perseverance, as stone is worn by continual dropping. Besides, you must know some day, as well now as later. Your name is Jane Eyre?"
"Of course,"
That was all settled before. You are not, perhaps, aware that I am your namesake? That I was christened St. John Eyre Rivers?
No, indeed. I remember now seeing the letter E.